Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Karen Breslau, San Francisco Bureau Chief of Newsweek. The current clash between Israel and Hezbollah is deep-seated in the conflicts that have stretched over the last century among the many cultures, national identities, and religions of the Arab world. Debate is heating up as developments in the Middle East further complicate the potential for resolution. Tonight, we hope to answer your questions by taking a serious look at the history of the conflict, the current conflict in the Middle East. To do that, we've assembled an impressive panel of experts. Let me introduce them. Dr. Noel Kaplowitz is a professor of international relations and Middle East affairs, having taught at UC Berkeley, UCLA, and UC Davis. He's conducted in-depth interviews with Arab and Israeli leaders on their self-images and perceptions of each other. His current work includes the impact of radical fundamentalist Islam on the Arab-Israeli relationship. Fred Wary is an international policy analyst at RAND, currently researching U.S. policy in the Middle East. He served as a U.S. Air Force officer and analyst in the Middle East, and most recently as a specialist on Iran at the Pentagon. Dr. George Bisharat is a professor of law and Middle East affairs at UC Hastings. Professor Bisharat has consulted with the Palestinian Legislative Council, and he's lived, studied, and traveled throughout the Middle East and recently returned from Lebanon. Andrew Ross is the executive foreign and national editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, overseeing all international news that appears in the paper. He also runs The Ross Report, a Chronicle blog addressing the current conflict in the Middle East. Please start, please welcome our panel, and we'll begin. Okay, since this is Middle East History 101, we're going to start with some basics. This isn't a quiz, but a chance to add some perspective to discussion tonight. The open war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon began after Hezbollah kidnapped two Israeli soldiers on July 12th, killing several others. But the fuse was obviously lit long ago. Some would say with Israel's earlier invasions of Lebanon in 1978 and 1982. Some would no doubt say much earlier. I'd like to start tonight by understanding the players. Dr. George Bisharat, what is Hezbollah? Is it a social movement, a political party, a terrorist group, a state within a state? Maybe you could put all the headlines in some context for us.
Sure. Well, I think Hezbollah, which means party of God in Arabic, is probably best described as a religiously based political movement. It's a very complex movement. It was founded in the early 1980s in the aftermath of Israel's second major invasion of Lebanon. And it was inspired directly by the ideology of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. And it has received aid and inspiration from Iran continually. It's one of its central aims early on, one of its central missions, was to fight against the Israeli occupation. Israeli troops entered in 82 and didn't really leave until the year 2000. So Hezbollah has a very complex structure. It does many other things. It participates in Lebanese elections. It builds schools. It helps educate students. It actually spends more than the Lebanese Ministry of Education on scholarships for students. So it's a very complex and sophisticated organization.
Fred Wary, could I get your assessment? What makes Hezbollah so powerful in Lebanon?
Well, I think it stems from several factors, some of which was already alluded to. It provides an enormous array of humanitarian services, from paving roads, building hospitals, scholarships. But more importantly, I think it's very pragmatic. It is an Islamist organization, but it's not bound by that ideology. For instance, its hospitals are open to Christians and other sects. In politics, it has formed alliances with other parties. So it has avoided many of the pitfalls that other Islamist groups have fallen into. Another important factor is the enormous charisma of Hassan Nasrallah. This is a leader that sent his own son, an 18-year-old, into battle. He was killed in 1996 by an Israeli barrage, and this won him enormous credibility. Nasrallah refused to negotiate with the Israelis for the release of his son's corpse. And finally, I think they're just very competent militarily. They were trained by the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Israeli soldiers in this last conflict noted that this group seemed not like a guerrilla organization, but rather a special forces brigade of the Iranian army.
Dr. Noel Kaplowitz, is there any analog in any other country for understanding Hezbollah? Is there any other social service slash military slash political organization in the Middle East that would compare to it?
Let me begin by answering that while I agree with the two previous accounts, I would add another dimension, and that is to say I think it's important, imperative, to see Hezbollah as part of a resurgence of a certain kinds or certain kinds of radical, militant, fundamentalist Islam, which differentiate those kinds of fundamentalist movements from what I would call mainstream Orthodox Islam. And the precise answer to your question is there is an analog. Hamas in Gaza and the West Bank developed its popularity in part because of social services. That's an ancient tradition in Islam, that social services and politics and quote-unquote religion or theology are intertwined.
Andrew Ross, you report today in your blog in the Chronicle, on the Chronicle website, that the current ceasefire, and here's the quote, hardwires the perception throughout the region that a non-state militant actor has defeated Israel by fighting it to a draw in a conventional war. Can you elaborate?
That was a quote. Thanks for the plug, by the way, for the Ross report.
You got it.
I want everybody to be clicking on a lot because we live or die by page views on the web. That was actually a quote taken from an intelligence consultancy called Stratfor, which writes any number of, as I'm sure everybody at this table knows about, and it was a sort of a quick take on what was regarded. And I think it expressed, I don't know whether I would call it yet conventional wisdom, but certainly a highly shared opinion of the sort of at least the psychological result of this conflict. In fact, I went on to throw in other quotes there which tended to disagree with it, including Tom Friedman, who wrote a column last week, who said he's heard that kind of talk before, you know, but at the sort of, in the end of the day, war tends to be about destructiveness, and certain lessons get learned by that. So I'm not necessarily as much in agreement with the quote that I actually put forward because, I mean, the blog is a place for various opinions to be put forward and to provoke discussion. But I think it is definitely a generally shared opinion, and clearly even the Israelis are very, very unhappy with the outcome. They expected to get more, and they didn't. Whether it was such an overwhelming victory for Hezbollah as being said, I think really remains to be seen. I'm a little doubtful at this point that it was.
Let me put this question to the entire panel. How is it that the highly regarded Israeli Defense Forces couldn't defeat Hezbollah in over a month of fighting when you think about the fact that in 1967 they managed to defeat the combined forces of Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, and Syria in only 6 days? What's changed? Dr. Kaplowitz.
Well, I mean, the obvious answer is it's a new kind of war. But I do want to say something. I was asked a broad question, the influence of Jewish and Israeli history on current Israeli behavior, and I want to tie it into what was just said about the Hezbollah psychological victory. There's no question that's the perception in Israel. I mean, Israelis are worried and depressed. One of the essential points to understand about the influence of history on current behavior is that although the Jewish national movement was established to provide a place, hopefully, of security for Jews who needed or wanted it, there's an even more fundamental purpose, and that is to provide dignity for the Jewish people. No state in the current world in which we live with nuclear weapons has absolute security. Dignity doesn't require that you not be attacked. But what dignity does require is that you be able to fight back, that as interviewee after interviewee told me in various ways, that Jewish blood wouldn't and couldn't be spilled with impunity. And that, I think, when I did my interviews as in the 60s and 70s with Israelis, asked them, tell me what comes to mind when you think of Israel's national purpose, the overwhelming response was not establishing a state which provide economic well-being or educational opportunities, but survival. And that has been undergirded by the advent of certain kinds of Islamic, radical fundamentalist Islamic movements, which assert not only that a Jewish sovereignty has no place, absolutely no place, any kind of Jewish sovereignty in the Middle East, but it must be fought constantly. And although Israelis are worried and depressed, I don't think there's any question in Israel, and there's any question, there's certainly no question in my mind that if Israelis are attacked, they're going to fight. I mean, Nasrallah was wrong. He thought that he referred to Israel as a fragile as a spider's web. And once it saw that its army was no longer invincible, it would begin to collapse. That I don't think will happen. So there's more than an element of truth in Friedman's balancing statement, let's say.
Fred Wary, let me get your assessment. Why did this war go on for 34 days without a clear outcome?
I think it's the classic dilemma of a conventional army that, as you mentioned, performs very well against a Syrian tank unit, but when confronted with guerrillas that find sustenance and support within a civilian population that melt away into that population that are difficult to track, it presents a new dilemma. And fighting that war initially with air power was puzzling to many of us, especially given the fact that they've tried that in the past with the 1996 Grapes of Wrath campaign that undertook attacks against infrastructure in Beirut. The calculus there was to try to pressure the Lebanese government to rein in Hezbollah. A similar logic appeared to be at work here, but it was flawed. I mean, to really go after a guerrilla group in a setting like that involves an entirely different type of tactic, small units, special forces, and I think the initial focus on air power was flawed.
George Bishrat, could you...
Well, I would add to these comments leadership, the very sophisticated, intelligent, cunning, you might say, leadership of Hezbollah in Hassan Nasrallah and other leaders of the Shura Council. There's a consultative body that actually rules Hezbollah. And the very, very strong commitment of its fighters. And that is partly a religious conviction, and that is partly a national conviction. These are people, many of them, who lost relatives. There were 18,000 Lebanese civilians who were killed during the first major Israeli invasion in 1982. A lot of these people who are fighting today are people who lost homes and people who lost loved ones in those battles, and they are determined for that not to happen again.
Just to sort of follow up a little bit, I think it really did help Israel in 67 that, for example, the Egyptian Air Force, the entire Egyptian fleet, was pretty much sitting out there, you know, in the open grass, away from a civilian area, just waiting to be hit. It sort of made things a lot easier, and that was a time when Israel was a lot quicker. So as was pointed out, it was a lot more conventional. I just think we don't yet know enough. I mean, clearly Israel miscalculated in some ways. They had a guy who I think was head of the IDF who came from the Air Force. There clearly was this idea that air power would do it. I don't know whether they were sort of thinking that they could do, you know, shock and awe a little better than the Americans did. I don't know whether they calculated that they would perhaps, to quote, decapitate the regime really quickly, which, as you might remember, the Americans tried to do in Iraq on the first day. And so when I think probably one of the first bombs, George, correct me if I'm wrong, were probably aimed probably at where they thought Nasrallah might be. And if you could, like, decapitate the regime, it would be over just like that. One final point. 34 days isn't really a very long time. We all have very short attention spans, and clearly the pressure came down to sort of end it. We don't yet know how much pressure the United States applied on Israel to accede to a ceasefire that was being negotiated. But again, one suspects, had it gone on longer, we don't know. No, they didn't win in 34 days, but given a longer time, we don't know.
This leads to my next question. Seymour Hersh reports in the latest New Yorker that Israel had devised a plan for attacking Hezbollah and shared it with the Bush administration well before the July 12 kidnappings of the Israeli soldiers. And he goes on to lay out evidence that the campaign against Hezbollah is being used to lay the groundwork for a potential attack on Iran's nuclear sites. Fred Wary, what are your reactions to these claims?
It's possible, but I think our thinking in terms of how to mount these operations has evolved beyond the real emphasis on air power that we saw. So that leads me to be skeptical a little bit of that we have sort of a broader view about how to conduct this. And applying this sort of limited operation in South Lebanon to looking at the attack on nuclear facilities, there's a little disparity there. So I'm a little skeptical. It's certainly possible.
Yeah, I sort of wish that Cy Hirsch would occasionally offer up a named source for his stories. I don't really quite understand how New Yorker editors continue to let him get away with it.
That's a discussion for another day.
The fact that, yeah, just get a, you know, take a diss at another journalist. You know, we love to do that. You know, so, George, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question that you raise, Andrew. It would be nicer if Seymour Hersh cited some names, which he did not much of in this article. But
he's been known to be correct on occasion.
He's not. So. He's been known to be correct on occasion, and of course he wouldn't be able to write these kinds of articles probably if he had to attribute sources in some of these cases. I think we have to realize too that what he really described was a faction within the Bush administration that was pushing hard for an attack on Iran, and that saw Israel's attack on Hezbollah as kind of a dry run because some of the logistical problems that they would face were expected to be similar, and there was curiosity about whether an air attack would be successful. And I think the conclusion of the article is that the results of this dry run, if that's indeed what it was, dress rehearsal, have been quite discouraging, and those within the Bush administration who would favor such an attack on Iran have probably been discredited, for better or for worse.
Dr. Kaplowitz.
It's one thing to assert that Israeli and American intelligence shared information about targeting, and my guess is that that's so. It's another to say that this was pre-planned and precipitated by the U.S., by the Bush administration. I wanted to say something in part in regard to the previous question explaining the military outcome objectively and subjectively. When I prepared for this, I reviewed the history of Israel and Lebanon, and what stood out was that Israel was provoked more severely in the late 70s by the PLO when Rabin was prime minister, and in the early 80s when Begin was prime minister, and neither of them initially responded with this kind of enormous operation. They responded in traditional Israeli terms, stern reprisals, equipping forces in Lebanon that were fighting the PLO, and so on. You have for the first time, once the generation of the fathers and mothers passed, Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir, all of the sons, virtually all of the sons who came to the fore in politics had exemplary military careers, and they were quite confident of themselves militarily. Rabin is an example of that. Others I don't have to go into. Now, for the first time, you have a situation in Israel where the prime minister and the defense minister don't have military experience on a macro level. I mean, Amir Peretz was a junior officer in the paratroopers and so on, but they don't have that experience. My own impression, but it's an impression, is that this operation, that Israel did not, the government did not take time to think through the implications of this operation.
Let's talk about Lebanon.
So, and I just want to add, once the data becomes available, and I speak as an international relationist now, I can promise you there will be a lot of people wanting to do dissertations on the decision-making process in Israel. But I don't, it doesn't have the mark of being pre-planned. I think they were caught by surprise and responded, in my judgment as an analyst, too quickly.
Let's talk about Lebanon. Why has Lebanon over the years been a host, whether witting or not, to forces that have brought it destruction? We have seen Lebanon destroyed over and over. Professor Bishop, you were just there. There was some sense of celebration about the latest renaissance in Beirut and the Cedar Revolution, and now it would appear to be in ruins again. What plagues Lebanon?
Well, I think it's a combination of a weak central government, which in a sense is a product of the history of the country. The country was carved out of Greater Syria by the French in order to sort of provide an enclave for the Christian population there. In many respects, the identity of the state has never really taken hold, and sectarian identities have remained strong. The nature of the political system itself is one which reinforces the importance of sectarian identities and religious identities. There's a 1943 National Pact, which basically divvies up all governmental offices and apportions seats in the parliament on the basis of sect and the like. So it was a weak and fragmented state without a strong identity. It also had the misfortune of being next to Israel and being the recipient of large numbers of Palestinian refugees who were forced from their homes in 1948, and that set in process a dynamic which, in a sense, we're still talking about and still seeing today.
A broader question, Fred Wary: how is this very cosmopolitan country become host now to what might arguably be called a fundamentalist organization?
I think to answer that, you have to really look at the roots of Shia disenfranchisement, their frustration with the state, stemming back into the 1920s and 30s, the fact that the Shia areas in the Bekaa Valley and elsewhere were tremendously impoverished. In the 1940s, there were hardly any hospitals in this region. It was tremendously cut off from the rest of Lebanon. This created a situation that was really ripe for an organization to step in and provide these sorts of social services that we've mentioned. This initially occurred in the 1970s with a cleric named Musa Sadr, and it was really the 1982 invasion by Lebanon that sort of galvanized the Shia and led to the creation of Hezbollah.
Okay. Let's talk for a moment about Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, who my Newsweek colleagues, here's another plug, referred to in a profile this week as perhaps the most charismatic figure in the Muslim world and very possibly the most dangerous. Andrew Ross, who is this man?
I'm not sure that I'm necessarily the best person.
Then let's pass it to Professor Bisharat.
Well, I'm not a biographer of the Sayyid, but I do know that he is a member of a prominent Lebanese Shia cleric family. He studied in Iraq, like many Shia clerics.
Iran or Iraq?
Iraq.
Iraq.
Yeah, and he's got a family. And he's a very bright, articulate man. And he is one, in many ways, who sort of set the tone for Hezbollah's dealings in Lebanese politics. I mentioned earlier that Hezbollah has participated in Lebanese elections. They have 14 seats in the parliament. They have two government ministers. And they've established a reputation in their dealings with other political parties and the like as being very honest and principled and keeping their word. And Nasrallah is a man in particular who is known for being principled and forthright and honest and decent. And he, I don't know where he gets this, but apparently there was a poll done within Israel that showed that the Israeli public trusts him to keep his word more than they do their own political leaders. That obviously is a self-serving reference, so I'm not really sure how valid it is, but he refers to it frequently. But he is known, I mean, his very reputation, his political reputation is based on his honesty, decency, and reliability.
Could I ask you a question, George? Do you mind, Karen, if not I just ask a question? If that's the case, and I can't quote chapter and verse from Nasrallah himself, but I have read, for example, statements from Hezbollah leaders talking about Israel and seeming and sort of talking about basically that one of their raison d'etre is to, quote, resist aggression. Well, what is aggression? From the statements I've read, aggression extends to mean the very existence of Israel on the land that it currently occupies, not only necessarily, but in sort of the pre-1967 borders, because the very existence of Israel is itself an act of aggression. If, in fact, Nasrallah and presumably Hezbollah by extension has a reputation for keeping its word, are those kinds of words that we need to be taking seriously?
That is a fair question. And it is true that Hezbollah is an organization which refers to the area you know as Israel, as occupied Palestine. And it proclaims in its charter that one of its principal aims is to liberate Jerusalem. I suppose it is important to take those kinds of claims and those kinds of ambitions seriously. I should maybe Fred will second this. I'm not sure. You should keep in mind, however, the pragmatism is also a characteristic of Hezbollah, and they have, for example, I mean they've been forgiving and charitable basically in dealings with their political enemies. So, for example, when they succeeded in ejecting Israel from South Lebanon in 2000, everybody expected that there was going to be a bloodbath because they would attack the various collaborators and all who had worked for Israel. Nothing of the kind happened. They have to be taken seriously, obviously. But they have to be understood as a political organization and as one that above all is pragmatic in its orientations.
Dr. Kaplowitz.
All totalist movements in the 20th century have pragmatic elements. I'm not going to go over those totalist movements that aim at
total win
for one side. There's no minimally satisfying goal other than total win for one side.
So Hezbollah can only win if Israel ceases to exist?
Which means the elimination of Israel as a Jewish sovereignty in the Middle East. But I have read about what Nasrallah has said recently, and I think it goes even deeper than what Andrew suggests. He, in response to this Israeli attack, and he said this publicly, and it was translated into English, talked about the savage attack of the Israelis. Understandable, I suppose, and then said, and they, presumably meaning the United States and the Israeli peaceniks and so on, and people in like-minded people in academia, and they want us to make peace with these savages, after which he added, the killers of the prophets of Allah. That's damn serious. That's damn serious. I know that I was invited here, not just because I'm a Middle East analyst, because my name is Kaplowitz, and I'm not somebody who talks about the Shoah and asks people for help in that regard. But speaking as a Jew just for a moment, I mean, I can tell you that there is hardly a Jew, I don't speak for all Jews, there's hardly a Jew who, when he hears Nasrallah say such things, doesn't pay attention. The Jewish community and its friends are very tense, and so is Israel.
Fred Wary.
Let me just add something about the way Nasrallah came to power that sort of argues against decapitation as a military strategy. In 1992, Israel carried out an assassination of the previous Secretary General, Abbas Mousawi. He was killed along with his wife and child. This was turned into an enormous spectacle in the Hezbollah community. There was an enormous outpouring of grief. Mousawi was hailed as a martyr. At a time when Hezbollah's support was lagging, this really galvanized the movement, and Nasrallah, I think, rose to power on the backs of this outpouring of grief, and he skillfully managed this event. Secondly, I will add that what George said, he's very pragmatic, very well-read. I saw an article in the Iranian press where he was reading Sharon's biography. He instituted, at his direction, Hezbollah founded their television station, Al-Manar, So he's a very skillful manager of PR.
He's a media guy.
Almanar Television has its own what they call Hebrew Observation Department, where they watch the Hebrew language press 24 hours a day, translate it. So he's a very, I think, astute observer of the other side.
I think at some point after the initial airstrikes, he popped up in a TV studio and was sitting there basically as an in-studio commentator on the air war.
Which
I think the Arabic word is chutzpah,
which wasn't
right?
Al-Manar, because Al-Manar apparently now was actually, in fact, destroyed. The studios in Beirut apparently were. There was a story in it today. So he must have been. They must have had other studios somewhere.
When this current round of conflict began, other Arab states, including Saudi Arabia, were openly critical of Hezbollah, which was very unusual to have open criticism within the Arab world. Has Nasrallah's prestige been enhanced in the Arab world as a result of taking on the Israelis for this period of time without a surrender? Is he more of a street force in the Arab world than he was 6 weeks ago? Fred Wary, why don't you take it?
I think so, and some evidence for that is that there are certain Islamist groups known as Salafis whose ideology is vehemently anti-Shia. These groups are having a very serious debate. Many of them are from Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabi religious establishment, that argue that, look, Hezbollah is a resistance organization. They should be supported, not necessarily because they're Shiites, because they're a party of Iran, but because of their resistance function. In Lebanon, there are tapes of Nasrallah's sermons being sold in Sunni Islamist quarters. Groups that would not necessarily be friendly toward the Shiites are endorsing Nasrallah because of this resistance function. And I think that's an interesting barometer for his growing popularity. Whether that lasts beyond this conflict, I think, remains to be seen.
I think this is a good time to start our audience questions, because there are a number of you out there who want some clarification for the division between Sunni and Shia Islam. One questioner says, my understanding is that Islam is supposed to tie different peoples together into a single faith, but the Islamic world seems to suffer endless fratricide. Could one of you take on a 101 version of the Sunni-Shia conflict?
Who would like to
catch that grenade?
A short stab at it. First of all, I mean, I think the perception that the Middle East is any more riven with conflict than any other part of the world is wrong and unhelpful. You know, after all, it was Europe that was the seat of two world wars, the second of which killed 50 million people. So, I think it's not a productive way to view the Middle East as one that's particularly violent, that has always been violent, always riven with conflict. That's simply not true, or no more true than any other region of the world. The Sunni Shia rift in Islam dates back to the early days of Islamic history in the 7th century, and basically it's a dispute about the succession of the caliphate. The Shia were the party. Shia actually means party of Ali, who was the nephew and son-in-law of the Prophet. And the Shia basically believed that succession should be by blood relationships, and Ali was the next one in line, whereas the Sunnis, the dominant orthodox sect in Islam, believed that it should be done by the consensus, by the choice of the sort of the close followers of the Prophet. There was a civil war fought between these two groups, and there were basically the Sunnis were the ones who came out on top. There were various leaders from the Shia movement who were killed, who were martyred, and they are sort of heroes of the Shia today. So Sunni remains the dominant Orthodox sect. It is the main sect of Islam. Shia still remain a minority in the Muslim world as a whole, although they are the dominant groups in the countries of Iran and Iraq, and they are the largest plurality today in Lebanon. There are a few other Shia in other Arab countries in the Gulf and the Arabian Peninsula and the like.
How would a Shia follower and a Sunni follower recognize each other? How would they distinguish? Would they immediately know this person is Sunni, this one is Shia?
No, probably not. Sometimes by name. I mean, you know, the name Hussein, for example, is a popular Shia name because that was the name of one of the early martyrs in Shia history. But generally, no, they're indistinguishable from each other. They do, in countries where they reside together in significant numbers, like Lebanon, they live sometimes in different areas, and they have different religious rituals to some extent. But otherwise, they don't dress differently from each other. They speak the same Arabic usually, if we're talking about the Arab world. So no, there are not major ethnic or other differences between them.
George, let me just add to that there are certain tribes in Iraq, for instance, that have both Shia and Sunni members. So even familial ties sort of supersede this sectarian division. And I think there are plenty of instances in Islamic history where these groups coexisted in a harmonious fashion. I think in times of economic and political uncertainty and turmoil, they revert back to these identities. The other interesting point is that in the face of foreign occupation or aggression, they will coalesce. A good example of this is the British during the 1920s in Iraq faced the concerted Shiite-Sunni resistance.
But not so much now in Iraq.
Andrew Ross,
I would answer the question by referring to, on a macro level, to the whole question of identities in the Middle East, and just say very briefly that what we in the field call particularistic nationalisms, Lebanese, Syrian, Jordanian, very recent phenomenon, really an epiphenomenon of British and French drawing of maps in the early part of the 20th century. They're not very well rooted. Arab nationalism is more deeply rooted, but as you can know from reading the media, also highly problematic. The notion of an Islamic ummah, Islamic people or nation or brotherhood is very, very deeply rooted on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you have what were called sectarian identities in the case of Lebanon, Shia, Sunni, and so on. I think also more deeply rooted than most experts, including myself, so-called experts, were expecting. I don't know anybody who predicted a Shia-Sunni civil war or approach to civil war. I think as somebody who observes the Middle East, I'm not sure that there is an Iraq, because the Sunni and Shia and certainly Kurdish identities seem to be much more primordial. And I hate to say it, because I don't think it does the West any good or America good or Israel any good. I don't know that there's a Lebanon. And I was stunned by the bombing of Shia mosques in Iraq. I never thought that would happen.
By fellow Muslims.
You say fellow Muslims, but by Sunni, Muslim, Salafi, or whoever did this. And I can tell you that the Shia haven't forgotten Ali. Ali is not a supposed hero. Ali is an icon for the Shia, and the Persians haven't forgotten the Arab conquest. The Shia of the Arab world will not forget for a very long time what went on in Iraq, and conversely, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, by way of explaining your question about criticism, the Sunni majority is afraid of a resurgent Shia crescent in Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon.
Andrew Ross, let me ask you, how do the rising Sunni-Shiite tensions in Iraq affect what we've just seen in Lebanon, if at all?
I'm not sure that they are. I think they're separate. I mean, the only thing that seems to have happened is that attention has been veered away from what's going on in Iraq. I don't think they're related, if anything, and this is a sort of very morbid point to make, but the deaths in Lebanon, as awful and tragic as they have been in terms of sheer numbers, pretty much outweighed on a day-to-day, week-to-week, and month-to-month basis of the deaths in Iraq that are not coming from, you know, American guns or planes. They're coming from Sunnis and Shiites killing each other.
And
there was, you know, and so far, certainly the one of the leading Shiite militias in Iraq has said we need to support Hezbollah. The prime minister came out and, of course, you know, made public statements in support of Hezbollah, or at least against the Israeli invasion. But I don't know that you had suddenly Iraq's sectarian differences suddenly all went away in support of the new hero of the streets, Nasrallah. Maybe it's happening and I haven't seen it.
There's some interesting evidence that Hezbollah may have been bracing for sort of the aftershocks of Iraq, the returning veterans. There was actually an attempt on Nasrallah's life in April, and following this assassination attempt, the Hezbollah spokesman came out and said that the culprit was a Sunni jihadist who was attacking Hezbollah because of what was happening to Sunnis in Iraq, so that there was some bleed over. Whether or not this was sort of a prepared statement or not, it does amplify sort of the war clouds on the horizon. Anthony Shadid in the Washington Post has written on this. In places like Tripoli, you're seeing sort of increased militancy because of the Iraq conflict.
As a reminder to our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program. And tonight we're taking a close look at the origins of the current conflict in the Middle East. I'm Karen Breslau of Newsweek, and I'm here with Dr. Noel Kaplowitz, Professor of International Relations, formerly at UC Davis, Berkeley, and UCLA, Fred Wary, Policy Analyst at RAND, Dr. George Bisharat, Professor at UC Hastings, and Andrew Ross, Foreign and National Editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. We're going to get back to your questions. It looks as though the forces driving behind present radical Islam are the imams and the mullahs. Any recommendations how to combat these clerics to stop them from preaching hatred? George Bisharat, you described Nasrallah in more cordial terms. How do you respond to this?
I think the best way to combat these kinds of movements in the Middle East is by making sure that we have fair and just policies in the region, and particularly that we encourage a fair and just resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If we were to do that, we would, in one fell swoop, take the wind out of the sails out of a lot of these movements, and we would restore our reputation internationally, and it would do us and a lot of other people a world of good. We don't seem, unfortunately, to be heading in that direction, but that's where we need to go, in my belief. When we do that, the number of people who stand still against us, and there will still be some extremists that we will have to face, but they will be a tiny minority in their societies. If you look at polling evidence on support for the creation of an Islamic State in the region, and there's a lot of this evidence, support in the region for that goal is absolutely minuscule. Among Palestinians who voted in the Hamas party in January, it's about 3%. In the rest of the Arab world, it's about 6%. Why do all of these people vote for these parties and support these movements? Because they stand up to Israeli power and they stand up to American power. So that's where the problem lies.
Is it possible to chime in on that one?
Chime.
Just very quickly. I think that it would certainly take a card off the table. Whether it take the wind out of the sails, I'm not so sure. You know, some of the, you know, the original theoreticians of what might be called, as a heuristic, sort of radical Islam, I don't think were paying a whole lot of attention to Israel and Palestine. I think they were paying attention to the West. The gentleman from Egypt, the scholar who came to Colorado, hated the West wrote a book which is perceived as sort of one of the sort of guiding influences for a number of radical Islamists who came after him, including Osama bin Laden, who was concerned about the West. Osama bin Laden's early campaigns and speeches and thinking was not so much, I think, about Israel and Palestine, but about other issues that sort of came later. So I just think that ought to be made. One other very quick point. I think it's very, very late to be tackling the issue of, you know, of extremist imams. It always surprises me that people are surprised, for example, about homegrown terrorists in England. Why would we be surprised? I mean, England, which sort of allowed Karl Marx to study in the library, which seemed like probably a good thing
at the time.
Also, for years and years, sort of allowed, you know, extremist race baiters, because essentially that's what they were, to basically preach away in London mosques, and everything was fine. And I think that helped to sow the seeds. You know, it's awfully late to be going to tackle it now.
Dr. Kaplowitz?
Karen, I wish it were the case that were a Palestinian state established, we would be finished with this problem. History is unforgiving. I, in 1999, went to Israel and did everything I could to help elect Barak, because I saw a once-in-a-lifetime chance for peace. Arafat said to Clinton, when Clinton was about to finish in office, "You're a great man," and Clinton said, "No, I'm a failure, and you made me a failure." I think we're beyond a Palestinian state. My answer to your question about how this can be combated, it's not really a prescription. It's a description and a prediction. When groups like Hezbollah or Hamas or Al-Qaeda act on the premises of certain kinds, and I choose my words carefully, of radical fundamentalist Islam, they're going to be hit. They're going to be hit by America. They're going to be hit by Britain. They're going to be hit by Israel. And that causes, over the very long run, a questioning about the validity of these premises. And I think, and I say it sadly, because I don't see an end to this for a long time, I think what you have is a struggle for the soul of Islam, which is being played out in the Arab and Muslim worlds. And that, I'm afraid, takes a very long time and has very with very uncertain outcomes.
Fred Wary.
I think opening the intellectual playing field in the Arab world and tackling the problem of censorship is absolutely key. There are moderate Islamist voices. Many of them are forced to find refuge in Europe, places like Switzerland, because of conditions out there. So I think sort of cultivating an intellectual sphere that allows debate to flourish, that sort of reduces the clerical monopoly that we see today on discourse in the Arab world is critical.
Thank you. Syria is predominantly Sunni. This is another question from the listener. And Hezbollah is a Shiite organization. Yet the U.S. media identifies Syria as a co-conspirator with Iran in funding and supplying Hezbollah. Can somebody explain the apparent contradiction in motives?
The enemy of my enemy is my friend would be one.
Realpolitik is another.
Okay.
That's the realpolitik adage.
And another basic question here. How many Palestinians were displaced in the founding of Israel in 1948? What percentage of people living in what was then known as Palestine were displaced?
About 750,000 Palestinians fled in fear or were forced from their homes in 1948. And that was about 80% of the population of the country.
Okay.
There were about 150,000 who remained and who now constitute the Palestinian citizens of Israel. They number now around 1.4 million.
And many hundreds of thousands remained on the West Bank and Gaza, which is a historic part of what the Arabs call Palestine and what the Jewish people calls the Land of Israel.
Here's a questioner who is confessing his or her bias. Professor Bisharat gave me a C in criminal procedure. So, let it be known. It is now known. Second comes a question.
I'm sorry. Anonymous grading, though.
It's a mistake to invite students.
Is it folly to import democracies into the Middle East without simultaneously importing the Bill of Rights or similar measures to protect basic civil liberties?
I think it's folly to imagine that democracy in the Middle East is going to resemble what it looks like here. I think it's also folly to imagine that democracy can be instilled at the point of a gun. I think it is going to be a sort of a long process in developing there, and I think that we can foster it. We can offer our own examples. We can offer our wisdom. But essentially, we have to promote an indigenous kind of democracy and an indigenous dialogue in which we may play an active and supportive role, but not more than that.
Economic development, I think, would help. There needs to be a sort of lifting of all boats, a vested interest in a developing economic and social society. And I think, and even a number of Arab scholars, I think, came out with, I think, what's something called the Arab Development Report, who have basically acknowledged that large parts of the Arab world are almost like drifting away from the rest of the world because the difference in development is so great. Along with development, it becomes a broader middle class, and a broader middle class does tend to be one of the key underpinnings of a democracy, no matter where it is.
Let me interject. Wasn't that supposed to be the theory of Lebanon, that you had an affluent, multicultural, mercantile society that would be immune to all this, all these primitive rivalries? Anybody? Audience.
Well. Yes,
And George knows better than I. Democracy was carved up in a slightly odd way, which I think has tend to make things a little difficult, because the way that seats, correct me if I'm wrong, the way that seats are sort of divided and divvied up in Lebanon tends to encourage a certain kind of, for want of a better word, sectarianism. So it was somewhat imperfect. And I think also the notion of this cosmopolitan mercantile society, I think, was true, I think, perhaps in certain parts of Beirut and certain other parts of the country. But so many other parts of the country, especially the Shiite South, had been simply left behind and ignored. And, of course, that was a root of a problem for Lebanon.
I think any effort at democratization has to look at reforming the military and ensuring that this key organ of the state views itself as a servant of the state, remains apolitical, does not see itself as the vehicle for a particular sect to advance its own interests. I think that was a fundamental flaw in the Lebanese experience when the army collapsed because it was rife with these sectarian identities. So, working our military reform hand-in-hand with democratization, I think, is key.
Very, very quickly, there was some hope with the Cedar Revolution, with the sort of the model that Rafik Hariri basically presented of development. I mean, he sort of led the way, and there was this feeling of economic growth and opportunity.
Could you identify Rafik Hariri?
He was the former prime minister who was slain in circumstances that are not entirely clear. There is a United Nations investigation. A number of fingers have been pointed at Syria, which also may be another reason why Syria and Hezbollah are friends, because the Hezbollah has consistently defended Syria at a time when Syria was basically forced out of Lebanon, essentially partly by the West, by the United States, France, and other powers. And Hezbollah actually came always to Syria's defense part, so there was, you know, that relationship between them. But now the kinds of seeds that were sown in Lebanon from sort of the model that Rafik Hariri basically presented are clearly now in grave danger. Mm-hmm. We don't know what's going to become of all of that.
Somebody asks, where does Hezbollah get the money to fund its extensive social programs? Fred, can you tackle that?
I think much of it does come from Iran, but a lot of it comes from the tradition of charitable giving within the Shia community. They have a number of enterprises overseas, many of which are illicit. I think that's another great source of their power, as we were talking about before, is their enormous fundraising capability. But I think the Iranian source is important, as well as sort of the charitable ones, too.
Okay, here's a tough one. What does the state of Israel have to do to stop the anger in the Arab world, Hezbollah and Hamas in particular? Aside from ceasing to exist, which I think we'll just take off the table as a theoretical option, okay?
you know, if Israel is perceived as weak, it's referred to with contempt, as did Nasrallah. If Israel is strong or assertive or overreacting, it's perceived as aggressive and imperialistic and even fascistic. I think Barak gave it more than anyone expected. I know the literature, the revisionist literature critiquing Camp David, and I don't think it at all holds water. I think the Clinton, Barak, Dennis Ross argument is much stronger. And
you're referring to the former Israeli Prime Minister,
Barak,
the former
Ehud Barak.
Dennis Ross, the former U.S.
True.
Negotiator
True.
For the Clinton
True.
And Bush administrations.
And history is unforgiving. I mean, there are many ways in which we can see that in the 20th century. When you make mistakes or you fail, history can be very radical. I do want to say, though, I think there is a struggle for the soul of Islam, and we could have an interesting discussion in which you might invite different people, experts on Islam, between what I would call radical fundamentalist and mainstream orthodox and reformist modernist Islam. A very good student of mine pointed out when I suggested this was going to take a very long time, he said, but the conflict is fought, the struggle is goes on every single day, and you can see instances of change. You put in a plug for Newsweek, and you put in a plug for your blog. I'll put in a plug for a publication that I just discovered, which comes out of Jordan, called Islamica. And if you want to see and hear and feel this debate about Islam, I recommend that you take a look at it. It's a fairly recent publication.
It's a website? As well?
No,
okay.
Geom and Neanderthal. It's not a website. Okay. It's an actual magazine. That you can buy in
Islamica.
Borders.
Okay.
Islamica.
Right. We'll boost their circulation. I'd like to, before we finish this evening, I'd like to talk about the U.S. role in all of this. Fred Wary, could you talk a bit about the U.S. role in the current conflict that we've just witnessed?
I think I'm immediately struck by the fact that the U.S. approaches this conflict with sort of another objective in mind, and that's either Iran or, more broadly, the war on terrorism. And the striking parallel to that is the 1982 invasion of Lebanon by Israel, in which Haig really viewed the conflict through a Cold War lens. Syria was a client of the Soviet Union, and this sort of clouded the ability to look at this conflict as a very local one. And I really think that was sort of a paradigm that guided our policy, at least initially, in terms of supporting the Israeli offensive. Later on, we realized that the casualties were turning Arab sentiment throughout the Arab world against us, so we supported the resolution.
Is the U.S. still respected as a broker in this conflict, given the initial reticence by the Bush administration to call for a ceasefire?
Well, perhaps as part of this revisionist history of what went on in Camp David in 2000, one of the participants, one of the American participants, Aaron Miller, referred to us as having performed the role of being Israel's lawyer. I think we've continued to be Israel's lawyer. I think we've continued to be Israel's lawyer in the United Nations. We've cast veto after veto, 7 out of the last 8 vetoes we've cast, and 40 out of 81 that we've cast in the history of the United Nations have been to protect Israel from essentially the enforcement of international law. And that is how we are perceived throughout the world. If you go anywhere else outside of this country, other than Israel, and I guess the Marshall Islands and Micronesia, because they usually vote, the 4 of them vote together, then that's the perception that we are Israel's broker, Israel's lawyer, and that's not where we need to be. We need to be America's lawyer, America's broker, working for American interests first.
Just a brief response, if I might. It's not an entirely bad idea for America to be on the side of the sort of the one democracy in the Middle East, and especially a democracy that's faced with eliminationist tendencies. I think America has made mistakes. I think America could perhaps have done more to help force a settlement and help create a Palestinian state. But I don't want to go too much down that road. It's interesting because when this conflict broke out, The Chronicle and any number of other media outlets wrote the same basic story. America has no role to play because we've burned all our bridges. We have nobody to talk to. It turns out that America brokered the deal. The problem is, if not America, then who? There is nobody else to broker a deal. It was really quite a surprise that at the end of the day, Condi Rice and the French brokered a United Nations deal. Where was Russia? Where were the other countries who maybe could have done something? Maybe behind the scenes they were doing something. Where has been the international community? I mean, it is all very well for, quote, the rest of the world to keep blaming America. Where is the rest of the world? Where is the international community?
The international community doesn't exist.
Fred Wary, last question to you. We're going to save that discussion for another day as well. What would you say is the best anti-terrorist pro-U.S. strategy in the Middle East? Yeah, that will be the last grenade of the evening. You have a minute.
I hope we can
take
a stab at that.
Go ahead.
I think broadly defined, it's recognizing that the solution has to come from within the region, that there are indigenous voices that are capable of transforming this region. I think it's media has a lot to do with it, opening the intellectual sphere, as we mentioned, recognizing that there could be a solution in front of our eyes that does not necessarily match democracy the way we define it. That the region is capable of inventing a pluralistic, liberal, consultative tradition that could stem from the integrate tribalism, Islamism, and just be open to that. And I don't think imposing a solution is the right way to go, but I do think public diplomacy efforts can play a role.
That concludes our time this evening. I'd like to thank our panelists for their provocative thoughts here tonight.
Congratulations.
This meeting, we've all survived. This meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.